Russian Art Academies be for training artists in the future? Art education system in London has its own history of transformation, overturning the system, and updating the system.
Mm-hmm.
And its structures have recently gone through another revolution to become from being independent art schools into a university system.
Mm-hmm.
And now the universities control the art education instead of independent art schools. So this is a government structural change, which has brought us into line with other countries, right? But it's also changed the way in which artists are taught.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And
we can begin with the questions.
I have to find my
glasses.
My first response is that it's a very big question.
Yeah.
Right? And it's a big question because I think the principles of education are under endless refinement and change. It's a long historical process in the last 150 years.
Right?
So I see it more as continuous. Absolutely continuous. But I think that what's interesting is that two international exhibitions should choose education as their priority. And what's interesting about that is that many curators recently, big international curators, have become deans or heads of art institutions. So, Enwizor or Daniel Birnbaum or Saskia Boss. I think that is what's making them think more about education. If you look at many international art biennales in the last 20, 30 years, they've been quite good from the side of production, from the point of view of allowing artists to produce considerable bodies of work, or funding new commissions. But what they've been very poor about is thinking about the reception, the work, and who are the audiences for art. And we seem to have moved from the question of audience in the last decade to the question of education. And it's not just about the education of artists, it's actually about the education of audiences. Because I think that Documentary 11 tried quite hard to have a debate, a discussion in the conferences it organised to build up the discussions around the subjects it wished to tackle. But I think there was another level of which Documenta also tried to work, which was with an education programme. And I think that became the model for Manifesta's new idea in Cyprus to have an art school. So I think there's more turn towards education because of those things in the debates in the international biennales, and a shift from thinking about audiences to thinking about the importance of education and the transmission of educational values in the context of an international biennale, and less about, and maybe it's to do with the failure of a proper public discourse in contemporary art. I wouldn't disagree with this as an objective. Right? I think that it depends very much on how national interest and nationalism is handled in that debate. Because there's a tendency, particularly in educational terms, to see in any particular country or state or city that one is only educating for a local population or a national population. And that one, because I come from London,
right,
and because of the institution that I work with in London, my institution has a moderately high proportion of international students. But it's not huge. You know, maybe it's 30%, 15 to 30% on some courses. Mm-hmm. So we are not just educating people who live in London mm-hmm. or who are working in London. We're educating people across the world who've come to London for their education.
Mm-hmm.
And this makes our... we have to think out of a provincial box.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't think, you know, London likes to think of itself as a dynamic, cosmopolitan, metropolitan place, but sometimes in our education it can seem very provincial because the goals and aspirations it's setting are to serve the national interest. And I think most other countries in the world and most other big art academies or big art institutions have that problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have to think who they're educating and what they're educating them for. Well, unfortunately, there's those very funny and ironic pieces of work which are about, you know, the main priority for an artist from Central or Eastern Europe is that they must speak English. you know
that's the work. That's the first discipline.
Unfortunately, I mean, I'm not, for my sins, you know, I am not an English speaker, but it is an irony of the situation that speaking English is now an international passport, and that you need you also need fluency in another language, French or German or Spanish, depending on where you're working in the world. And so it's not just that you have to speak one language, you have to speak many languages.
Right.
And I think that is becoming increasingly important to one's portability as an artist. And what comes with that is not just the ability to have a conversation, but the ability to understand cultural context, be sensitive to political and social cultural issues, think about the ways in which your work translates from one context into another, or doesn't. I mean, there's many pieces of work that are made deliberately because of the artist lives in one country, and they make a piece of work about political and social issues in another country. And to be able to do that effectively and pointedly. The situation at the moment is that in the last maybe 5 years there's been a slow retreat from that position in some places. In most of the small previously independent art schools that were universities, there's been a retreat from that position where when the actual needs of artists are going in a different direction. So there's a conflict there from the position that I see it in. However, Britain has had some remarkable courses where those things have come together and been encouraged. But it's not universal. And so it's not universal. And I wouldn't want to overstate the... I mean, for me personally, I think it's extremely important that artists have an in-depth understanding of the critical and theoretical context in which they choose to work. But how that is done and how that is structured is really a big question. I also think that it depends. It's too easy to give the solution that if you study X, Y, and Z, you're going to be up to date in contemporary art. You know, because always new theories are introduced, new ideas are introduced. And what is more important is that there should be a kind of liberal resource, a very, very extensive resource of a wide range of different things that are available.
Mm-hmm.
There are some interesting theoretical problems about this. For example, in the UK, a theorist who's very important in Russia, like Bakhtin,
yeah.
is hardly known and discussed.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So there are elements missing from the canon of ideas or the range of ideas that are discussed in one context that are very present in another.
Mm.
Okay. So I think it's more about finding careful ways of connecting and cross-fertilizing the absences and presences in different debates. And it's a much more subtle scheme of opening up ideas than actually saying this is the body of literature that should be studied.
Okay.
Because I think that there are very important theorists in Russia mm. who are hardly known here, which if you think that all the work has to be done with bringing up authors from abroad into Russia,
mm-hmm.
you know, then you're going to miss a very important element of the debate or how the debate could be structured and framed. Well, in the end of the 19th century, it was that case in Britain that a lot of private, individual articles were set up and then effectively nationalised. And now we have their nationalisation under a university structure. You know, and further, the structuring of everything that every university does under the Bologna process.
Yeah.
Right? So instead of fragmentation, we've got a real attempt at unification. Okay, so instead of lots of independent initiatives, what we have are a centrally organized plan, and everybody conforming to that centrally organized plan, even though the content of each course might be completely different.
Right.
He was talking about, do I see a problem between commercial initiatives and state-funded initiatives?
Right.
And I said, not really,
mm-hmm.
because in Britain in the 19th century it was like that. Right? There were private art schools and there were national art schools, and the whole thing was unified. And it's been unified several times, under a diploma system, under a university system, and now we have a very tight university structure. We don't have any private art schools.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, we do. We have individual artists who allow people to come and work with them and pay them,
yeah. But
nothing else. The interesting problem that we have now is whether the most successful artists teach in the art school or not. And many of the independent artists don't teach in the art school. Okay, so this book, Art After 1900, this book was. Was devised by the October Group to be the classic textbook, the sole textbook that every art student must purchase. Right, that's its aim. Now, this fits extremely well with the American art school system, where they do recommend one textbook that every student must read. Right?
Art and Theory.
Yeah, Art and Theory. Right, or some one book that everybody must buy and that will be the key teaching book. However, in Britain, nobody works like that. Nobody works like that. We don't have a single orthodox canon, even on the survey courses that are taught in art history. It's very eclectic, it's up to the individual teacher, always multiple texts recommended. So, what is interesting is that this book will serve the 16 to 18 year old market in England, which is an A-level market, which is pre-student education, right? And its value for art school students will be less because of that. sure it will be for younger students and less popular students that it will have a value. And the resistance to this book was very strong. The Art Historians Association in Britain organised a big conference, and the resistance to this book was enormous because many of the art historians, the professional art historians, didn't want this book to be discussed in this way because they felt that it was a purely promotional exercise on behalf of the publishers, and that it wasn't a serious venture for the education of art students. You see what I mean? It's a difference between how the American market works and how the British market works. And however, what's interesting is that having spent 20, 30 years fracturing and intervening and upsetting the kind of modernist canon, here they are, you know, much later in their professions, establishing a canon of artists. And they're attempting to shift certain ideas and change certain ideas, but it's still a very conservative book, you know, and it really is written for American market and not most British. I certainly think the British reception of it is very ambivalent, and it won't have the impact that it will have in the American market in Britain, because there have been several books like this. I mean, John Burgess' Ways of Seeing, or Gombrich's Art and Civilization, or Robert Hughes' The Shock of the New. You know, all of these books have been used in Britain, but they've only been used for 16 to 19-year-olds. And when it comes to the serious art education, as adults, they're not used. Precisely by publishing this gender art theory anthology with Mila Rudikina, and this was designed to reveal my interest in my specialism, which is the discussions about feminism in contemporary art, and to overcome what I saw as the misunderstandings and the lack of depth about what feminism has been in the last 30 years in Russian circles. So it's an intervention, calculated intervention. So I hope that it will deepen the debate, you know, and raise a lot of interesting material. And I would recommend the anthology approach, right? Rather than choosing a canon of books and works. I mean, obviously there will always be some, but hasn't Miziano also been doing that in his attempts at publishing? You know, and the other book series that the Open Society has been doing has taken the view of, you know, here is the author, the book that should be done. But most of art criticism and the important literature of art criticism is actually essays. You know, it's a really important thing, and the essay form for the discussion of art. And so the translation of particular essays in an anthology could have a greater impact than the translation of all the books by one author, or key books by one author. Yes, but the Clement Greenberg is a good case of the essay being more significant than the book.
Yeah.
And that there are maybe 10, 12 key essays of Clement Greenberg, and no more, because the rest of it is very... It's very detailed analysis of individual artists and individual works, and less general art theory. In my institution, University of the Arts London, what they do is There's a very strong emphasis upon professional practice. And what they mean by this emphasis upon professional practice is teaching or training artists with business skills, with publicity skills, with understanding how the art market works, with looking at different people's career paths and thinking about the ways in which they survived, made money, continued their practice. And this kind of model of professional practice should be an important component of art education, I believe.
Yeah.
But it doesn't necessarily have to take place in the art school, because there are some very good models of mentoring practices, which means that after education,
there's you again.
After education, a younger artist is supported by an older artist, and basically the artist meets regularly and tries to encourage the younger artist in a career path, in thinking about how they could find opportunities, develop their career, manage their life, manage their work time, you know, and give that support over a number of years, so that there is a transition between the formal art education and professional life. Because for most young artists, that is the hardest time. It's not the formal education, it's what happens after the formal education into professional life and gaining opportunities. And that there are many interesting and competent artists who fail because they can't earn a living, they can't manage their time, they don't find a professional studio, they haven't got the money to purchase the materials to make the works, they don't have connections with curators and critics, they don't see the importance of having connections with curators and critics.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you end up with is a kind of survival of the fittest, you know, those who are supported by friends or colleagues, and those who are just left and don't proactively seek out those opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
But could be making extremely good work.
Mm.